Hey, so the nation's capital is crawling with armed military personnel, armed police patrols, and armed thugs in the employ of Baker and Stanton. Your mission, then, is not going to be an easy one. The president is under armed guard, or at least he's supposed to be. He's also supposed to be in the company of General Ulysses S. Grant, who is known to always be armed. Of course, Grant has fortuitously opted to get out of Dodge just hours before he was to have accompanied the Lincolns to the theater, but you shouldn't have any way of knowing that, just as you shouldn't have any way of knowing that Parker will desert his post. And there will be no shortage of other armed personnel, including Army Captain Theodore McGowan, no relation, who is seated very near the door to Lincoln's box seats. So you have to assume that you're going to have to get past at least two armed attendants, probably more, to get to the president, and you're going to have to do that without firing a shot, since you only have one, and you'll need to save that for Abe. And since the only realistic chance you have of actually killing Lincoln with your wildly inaccurate weapon is by sneaking up behind him and delivering a contact wound to his head, you're going to have to get past any guards without making any noise. And since Grant is supposedly already on the hit list, you're going to have to kill him as well, which I guess you'll have to do by bludgeoning him with your empty gun. That should work out pretty well. You're not on a suicide mission, by the way, so even if you somehow manage to successfully assassinate the president, and presumably General Grant as well, you're still going to have some major problems on your hands. First of all, you're going to have to make your escape from a theater full of people, many of them armed, because in April 1865, the beginning of the era that will be mythologized as the Wild West days, there are guns everywhere and everyone is packing heat. And you, of course, will have blown yours and will be unarmed. If you somehow manage to make your way out of the theater, then you will have to face the daunting prospect of making your way out of the city and across the Potomac. And as I may have mentioned, D.C. is swarming with armed soldiers, armed spies, and armed police, as well as armed citizens. And your only means of defending yourself will be with a dagger, which probably isn't going to be very effective. Your goal is to reach the Navy Yard Bridge, which will get you across the Potomac and to relative safety. But even if you reach it, you still have a big hurdle to overcome. The bridge has a strict curfew, and the armed guard is under standing orders not to allow anyone across without explicit authorization. If you attempt to cross anyway, you'll be shot. A gun might come in handy, but you won't have one. To recap then, you've set a very ambitious goal for yourself. You must first get to the president, who is sitting in a private box in a crowded theater with at least two armed attendants. You must then kill the president with a single shot because your weapon doesn't allow for second chances, and somehow kill General Grant. You must then, in an unarmed state, make an escape first from the theater and then from the city. You must get past an armed guard at the bridge, and you have to do all of that with just one bullet. It's hard to see how anything could go wrong with such a brilliant plan. Of course, it doesn't have to be this way. There are other weapons available, weapons better suited to your mission. And as an alleged Southern operative, you should surely know that. It was, after all, Confederate guerrilla groups that pioneered the shock and awe tactic of using overwhelming force in the form of multiple revolvers. We've all seen images of Wild West gunslingers riding hard with their reins in their teeth, six-shooters blazing in both hands. It's only natural to dismiss such images as hackneyed Hollywood creation, but strangely enough, it's actually not. Rebel groups like Mosby's Rangers and Quantrill's Raiders really did train to do exactly that, and they wore custom-made holsters that could hold as many as six revolvers, three on each side. That allowed them to get off as many as 36 shots before their overwhelmed Union adversaries, armed with muskets, could reload and get off as much as a second shot. Those semi-mythical figures in the American history that we know as Frank and Jesse James, and Jim, Bob, John, and Cole Younger, and Bill, Gratt, Bob, and Emmett Dalton learned the skills that they later employed as Wild West outlaws while riding with the likes of William Quantrill and Bloody Bill Anderson. But that's not really the point here. The point here is that revolvers are easy to come by and might serve you better than a nearly worthless single-shot Derringer. And according to the official story, you definitely have access to at least two of them, pictured below. There are other things you might want to consider as well, such as not committing the crime as John Wilkes Booth. You are, after all, a famous stage actor, which means that you are also a wardrobe and makeup guy, because in your era, you and your contemporaries have to handle those duties yourselves, so you travel with a couple of large trunks full of stuff like wigs and fake beards. You could easily don a convincing disguise so as not to be so easily recognized. Then you don't have to worry about getting out of the city alive. All you have to do is make it out of the theater, quickly ditch the disguise, and you can circle around and rejoin the crowd at Ford's without arousing any suspicion at all. And you do, after all, have a lot at stake. Even if you manage to make an escape from D.C., your lifestyle and career will be distant memories. All the fame, the female adoration, all the success, all the wealth, it will all be gone if you commit the crime as John Wilkes Booth. So you might want to put on a disguise and replace that Derringer with a revolver or two, and maybe bring an accomplice or two along for additional firepower. You have quite a few co-conspirators to choose from. You also might want to reconsider whether Ford's Theater is the best place to do this. According to numerous historians, Lincoln has a bad habit of ignoring advice from aides and strolling around Washington unescorted at times, leaving him seriously vulnerable. that might make it a bit easier to successfully pull this off. In summary, then, your best bet is to probably make the attempt on Lincoln's life when he is alone and unprotected, and you should probably bring along some more impressive firepower, just in case. If you are determined to do it in the theater, you should don a disguise and bring along a couple of other gunmen, just in case one or more of you are killed and physically prevented from reaching the president. The dumbest thing you could probably do would be to go it alone as John Wilkes Booth and arm yourself only with a derringer. But I guess you can't argue with success, right? Meanwhile, one of your comrades in arms, Lewis Payne, has a difficult task ahead of him as well. His goal is to kill Lincoln's Secretary of State, William Seward, who is recuperating at his stately manor in the heart of D.C. after being severely injured in a fall from a horse-drawn carriage just 9 days earlier. Seward had suffered a broken lower jaw, a fractured right arm, torn ligaments in his foot, and heavy bruising over much of his body. The 63-year-old Secretary of State is therefore physically vulnerable, but assassinating him is still not going to be easy. For starters, Payne is going to have to gain access to the estate. Then he's going to have to find Seward without knowing the layout of the home or which floor or which of the many floors the secretary is in. He's going to have to get past a lot of people because there are no less than 8 other able-bodied adults in the home, 5 of them men, 2 of whom are military personnel. But there are readily accessible weapons in the home, and as I may have mentioned, there are armed patrols all over the city, and they are quite capable of quickly responding to any signs of a disturbance at the Secretary of State's residence. The attack on Seward has been all but written out of our history books, but in 1865 it was portrayed as an integral component of the plot against Lincoln, particularly during the show trial of the alleged conspirators. It is now mentioned only in passing, if at all, which is probably because the story doesn't make a whole lot of sense. In the home are William Seward, the injured Secretary of State, William Bell, Seward's black servant, Frederick Seward, William's son, as well as his assistant Secretary of State, Major Augustus Seward, another son and career Army officer who will be promoted in just a few weeks to Lieutenant Colonel, Private George Washington, Seward's personal attendant, who will be promoted to Sergeant in a few weeks, Emmerich Hansel, a U.S. State Department courier, Frances Seward, the Secretary's wife, who will be dead very soon, Fanny Seward, his daughter, who will be dead fairly soon, and finally the wife of one of the Seward sons. Payne, of course, is going it alone, just like Booth, for reasons that apparently never required an explanation. The 5 able-bodied men in the house, at least a couple of whom are likely armed, will pose a physical challenge. The 3 women will likely pose less of a physical threat, but one or more of them are very likely to run out into the street to summon any nearby patrols. And just the fact that there are so many people in the way will make it extremely difficult for Powell to control the situation. Payne's mission is not unlike Booth's. He must enter the building, work his way past any resistance to get to his target, take out his target, work his way back out of the building past any resistance, and then somehow find his way out of Washington. But unlike Booth, Payne won't have even a single bullet to work with. Instead, he's going in armed only with a bludgeon and a knife, and he'll be coming out with nothing but the clothes on his back. Technically speaking, he will be carrying a gun, but it doesn't work and so is only useful as a bludgeon. In a city overflowing with guns, Payne has chosen to bring one that doesn't work, which means that, luckily for the Sewards, no one was going to die. Payne, though, is going to leave quite a trail of destruction once he enters the estate, which sits just a half a dozen blocks from Ford's Theater. Frederick Seward will be left gravely injured, with his head reportedly split open and his skull fractured in 2 places. Major Augustus Seward will also receive severe head injuries, with one report claiming that he was half scalped. Private Robinson will also be seriously wounded, with deep stab wounds to his chest. Emmerich Hansel will receive at least 1 deep, very serious chest wound as well. Fanny Seward will be wounded in some unspecified manner, and William Seward, who is lying in bed on his back, unable to defend himself, will be brutally stabbed about the head and neck, but will, despite his already weakened condition, miraculously survive. It's difficult to believe that the attack on Secretary of State Seward ever took place at all. Lewis Payne supposedly gravely wounded 6 people in hand-to-hand combat, 4 of them able-bodied men, and yet, as photos taken soon after his arrest just days later reveal, he didn't have so much as a scratch on him. He supposedly left his hat, gun, and knife behind, creating a handy evidence trail. But why would he leave his only weapons behind? He also allegedly left a bloodstained coat with gloves and a fake mustache in the pocket in the woods just outside of D.C. Lewis Payne was apparently a very considerate attempted assassin. The descriptions of the conditions of the victims came from the first 3 people to conveniently arrive at the crime scene: Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, Secretary of Navy Gideon Welles, and Surgeon General Joseph Barnes. You know, just your typical first responders. None of them reported seeing Augustus there. Stanton initially claimed that only William Seward, Fred Seward, and George Robinson were injured. Augustus Seward, Emmerich Hansel, and Fanny Seward were later added to the victim list, apparently so that the prosecution would have suitable witnesses. It was an entire month before Fanny Seward came forward with her account of the attack. Augustus was later presented at trial as both a victim and an eyewitness to the attack that very likely didn't take place in the home that he wasn't actually in at the time. His testimony was wildly at odds with that of Robinson, with both men claiming that they had been in the room and personally witnessed the attack on William Seward. Not only did their accounts significantly differ, but neither was really explained why it was that, with the two of them in the room, and with Frederick and Hansel in the home as well, were they unable to defend the secretary. It is impossible to determine whether the alleged attack ever took place, but it appears extremely unlikely. It does not seem logistically possible for one barely armed man to have done what Payne is supposed to have done, and it doesn't seem physically possible for him to have done so without sustaining a single visible injury. There is no tangible evidence that Payne ever entered the home at all. The only evidence that has ever existed is the dubious and conflicting accounts told by the alleged victims and by the high-ranking cabinet officials who just happened to be first on the scene. Let's now briefly review the key elements of this story. Two assassins, three targets. Numerous people to get through to get to those targets. Numerous other people to get by to flee the scene. A city essentially under martial law. And one, exactly one, bullet. Anyone see anything wrong with that scenario? And that's the end of part two. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, click on the features tab, jump down to Lincoln, feel free to pick up with us in part three. Jump over to the books page and consider purchasing a book or making a donation to support his family and work. And so thank you as always for joining me again. My name is Mark. This is the Pure Grace Podcast, and we look forward to catching you next time. Take care.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today we're going to pick up in part three of
Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination is Wrong.
An Anatomy of a Presidential Assassination, written by the late David McGowan. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, hit the features tab, jump down to Lincoln, and pick up with us in part three. Let's jump right in. Anyone notice anything peculiar about the two images of Lewis Powell in my last post? Anything at all? Other than, of course, the fact that one of them had been colorized, making it appear unsettlingly contemporary. Because they are, to be sure, very unusual images. There's really nothing else like them in all of recorded history, except for, that is, the remarkable images that also exist of most of his alleged co-conspirators. And perhaps it's time for us to now meet those alleged conspirators, beginning with the rather dashing gentleman pictured below, Mr. Samuel Bland Arnold, who looks almost like he could be a 21st century actor posing for a publicity photo for his latest blockbuster film. Arnold was 30 at the time of the assassination and was working as a commissary clerk at Fortress Monroe, Virginia. He was said to be a former Confederate soldier, though it seems very likely that he was actually a Union operative, as appears to be the case with almost all of Booth's alleged accomplices. The files of the Bureau of Military Justice, a misnomer if there ever was one, contain the following tidbits of information on Arnold. Quote, Samuel B. Arnold was born at Georgetown in the District of Columbia of highly respectable parents. He was first sent to be educated at Georgetown College. From there, he was sent to the Reverend J.H. DeShills in Baltimore County, his parents having removed from Georgetown to Baltimore. He was 1 year in Rockingham County, Virginia, under the charge of Reverend Mr. Gibbons, and afterwards sent to St. Timothy Hall, Catonsville, Maryland, and placed under the Reverend L. Van Bekalen. The picture here is of a well-educated young man who had a rather privileged upbringing in and around the nation's capital. Not at all the kind of guy that you would expect to have donned a Confederate uniform, unless he did so as a covert Union operative. Arnold was convicted of complicity in the plot to kill Lincoln and was handed a life sentence by the military tribunal. He served only 4 years, though, before being pardoned by President Johnson and released in 1869. Arnold lived to the ripe old age of 72, passing away on the autumn equinox of 1906. Next up is Michael O'Loughlin, who, like Arnold, was a ruggedly handsome, well-dressed young man from a well-to-do family. Just 24 when Lincoln was shot, O'Loughlin had known Booth since childhood, when they had lived across the street from each other in Baltimore. Arnold had also been a childhood friend of Mr. Booth. The Bureau of Military Justice files reveals the following about O'Loughlin. Quote, Michael O'Loughlin was born in the city of Baltimore. He was educated at a school conducted by a highly respectable teacher at the corner of Front and Lafayette Streets, and after leaving school, learned the trade of ornamental plaster work and also acquired the art of engraving. The company he was in the habit of associating with was not of a character that a person indisposed to evil would have made choice of. His appearance was generally of a genteel character. In 1865, O'Laughlin was working for his older brother as a clerk in a Baltimore feed store. The brother, according to the government files, was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. Testimony before the military tribunal indicated that Michael likely was as well. Convicted by that tribunal, O'Laughlin was given a life sentence, which proved to be a death sentence when he contracted yellow fever in prison and died, strangely enough, on or about the autumn equinox of 1867. His remains are interred at the same Baltimore cemetery where Arnold and Booth can be found. Like Arnold and O'Laughlin and Booth, David Edgar Harold, H-E-R-O-L-D, frequently identified in print as David Harold, H-E-R-A-L-D, was a well-educated young man from an upscale family. Harold was born in Maryland and raised, where else? In Washington, D.C. His father was the chief clerk at the Washington Navy Yard store, the same Washington Navy Yard store whose guarded bridge Booth and Harold were inexplicably allowed to cross on the night of April 14, 1865. Harold attended Georgetown College, followed by the Rittenhouse Academy, and then the prestigious Charlotte Hall Military Academy. He later went on to work for various pharmacists and doctors, including our old friend Dr. Francis Tumblety. On one occasion in 1863, when he was dispatched to the White House to deliver a bottle of castor oil, Harold had the honor of personally meeting President Lincoln. Tried along with seven of his alleged co-conspirators, Harold was found guilty and sentenced to death by hanging. That sentence was carried out on July 7, 1865, just after Harold's 23rd birthday. He is, as would be expected, buried in the Congressional Cemetery in Washington, D.C. Thus far, we have met four lads, Booth, Harold, McLaughlin, and Arnold, who all were raised in and worked and lived in the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area. Considering the conspiracy to kill Lincoln, to the extent that it was acknowledged at all, is invariably cast as a Confederate conspiracy, but there don't appear to be too many Southerners in the crowd. There was at least one, though, our old friend, Lewis Thornton Powell. The youngest of the alleged conspirators, just 20 at the time of the assassination, Powell was also known as Lewis Payne, P-A-I-N-E, Lewis Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, Reverend Wood, the Reverend, James Wood, Mosby, and Kinchelo, among other aliases. As his shadowy identities would seem to apply, he was by many accounts an intelligence operative. Raised in Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, Powell was educated by his father, the Reverend George C. Powell. Lewis entered the service at a young age, either 16 or 17, depending on the source. Powell's two older brothers enlisted as well, with all three serving in the 2nd Florida Infantry. Lewis was the only one of the three to survive the Civil War. Wounded at Gettysburg in early July 1863, he was taken prisoner and sent to a POW hospital. Following his recovery, he was put to work as a male nurse in a hospital in Baltimore, from where he reportedly escaped, apparently by basically walking out the door. After that, according to historian Theodore Roscoe, author of The Web of Conspiracy, his, quote, movements are hard to follow. Author Jim Bishop added in The Day Lincoln Was Shot that, quote, there's an unexplained hitch in his military records, unquote. According to various accounts, he went to work with the paramilitary forces serving under John Singleton Mosby. In January 1865, he turned up in a boarding house in Baltimore, Maryland, and allegedly became a Lincoln assassination conspirator. On July 7, 1865, he was hanged. There is scant evidence that Powell knew Booth at all, although an apocryphal tale is often told of a young Lewis meeting Booth in a theater following a performance by the acclaimed actor. There doesn't appear to be any evidence at all linking him to the other alleged conspirators. He photographed really well, though. Moving back up north, we next meet the hapless Ned Spangler, also known as Ed Spangler, Edward Spangler, Edmund Spangler, and Edmund Spangler. The oldest of the alleged male conspirators at 39, Spangler was a journeyman carpenter originally from Pennsylvania, though he had spent the majority of his life in the Baltimore area. During the Civil War, he was living in Washington, D.C., where he was employed at Ford's Theater as a carpenter and stagehand. Spangler had met Booth many years earlier when he worked on the Booth family's Tudor mansion. In the aftermath of the Lincoln assassination, he was accused of holding Booth's horse and aiding and abetting the actor's escape from the theater. The charges, though, were dubious at best. Sentenced to a 6-year prison term, the most lenient sentence handed down by the military tribunal, he was pardoned 4 years later by President Andrew Johnson. Spangler died on February 7, 1875, reportedly of tuberculosis. Next up is the only foreign national in the group, George Andrew Azeroth, who was brought over to America from Germany when he was 8. Raised in, of course, Maryland, Azeroth and his brother owned a carriage repair shop where George worked as a painter. At the time of the assassination, he was 29. The military tribunal maintained that Azeroth had been assigned the task of assassinating newly installed Vice President Andrew Johnson, but allegedly had lost his nerve and failed to carry out the assignment. In truth, there was really no evidence that Johnson, who was likely involved in or at least had knowledge of the plot, was ever targeted. As with Stanton, this was a case of the conspirators themselves claiming to be the intended victims. Azarote was found guilty of his alleged crimes and was hanged on July 7, 1865. The seventh of the alleged conspirators was Dr. Samuel Mudd, yet another Marylander. Like many of the others, Mudd was born into a large, well-to-do family, and he was well